Welcome to OncoFarm. I'm your host, John Bizarre. I am a professor of pharmacy practice here at the supporting sponsor of OncoFarm, ETSU's Bill Gadd College of Pharmacy. It is the last episode of April 2024. I've got about seven updates to pass along, so pretty packed episode. First, we are going to start with the publication from last week's New England Journal of Medicine of Keynote 564. This is the pivotal study of adjuvant pembrolizumab in renal cell carcinoma. We have known that it prolongs disease-free survival. This is the publication demonstrating overall survival benefit of adjuvant pembrolizumab. Just as a brief refresher, these are folks with stage 2 disease, if it's a grade 4, so very aggressive disease, and then stage 3 disease, so node status, and a few folks with metastatic disease with no evidence of disease getting either placebo or pembrolizumab for a year. The disease-free survival impact benefit seen with pembro was heavily propped up by the DFS benefit in the M1 cohort, if you look at the subgroup analysis. Those folks with metastatic disease getting, quote, adjuvant pembro. And I was very critical, thinking, I'm not sure this will show overall survival benefit, especially if you took out those folks with M1. Well, I am eating my words, because we do see significant overall survival benefit, and we'll get to that subgroup analysis later. So the after almost 60 months, almost 5 years of follow-up, the hazard ratio for death was 0.62, confidence interval 0.44 to 0.87. Estimated four-year overall survival is 91 versus 86. We cut right to the overall survival rates. They're getting a year of pembro. So after a year, there's basically no difference in overall survival, 0.6% improvement with pembro. Now, if you go to 2 years, to 3 to 4, the delta, the absolute difference in estimated overall survival, goes to 2.4%, to 4.2%, and to 5.2%. So this overall survival benefit appears to grow over time with only 1 year pembrolizumab. So it certainly does seem to be overall survival benefit with adjuvant pembrolizumab in these folks with locally advanced or this high risk for recurrence renal cell carcinoma. And if you look at the subgroup analysis, and when you look at the subgroup analysis, you're looking for kind of anything funny here. The hazard ratio in those folks who were not metastatic was 0.63. That's really close to the hazard ratio for the entire population of 0.62. You look at those who are M1, so metastatic disease with no evidence of disease after metastatectomy, that hazard ratio was 0.51. Not nearly as beneficial as for those folks at, as far as a ratio compared to the disease-free survival number. So looks to be a good study. We do see overall survival benefit in these folks with adjuvant pembro. Now, that's Keynote 564, published April 18th, New England Journal of Medicine. Roughly the same time, probably the same time, actually, I guess, ASCO genitourinary was going on, and there was an oral abstract of a very similar study design. This is adjuvant nivolumab in renal cell carcinoma. Now, this is CheckMate 914. There was actually a cohort that was Nivo plus Ipi versus placebo and Nivo versus placebo. We're just talking nivolumab, because if pembrolizumab showed an OS benefit, then why isn't it that I'm talking about nivolumab abstract and not a publication? Because it did not show overall survival benefit. So why could that be? Is it perhaps pembro is a better drug? A question I've been asking myself lately. I don't know. Maybe one day I'll have time. I'll do a big deep dive on like the molecular characteristics of these agents. But for now, I think the answer lies in the differing methods of the Keynote 564 pembro study and the CheckMate 914 nivolumab study. So the nivolumab study was more inclusive. They enrolled people with a T2A lesion, so like a stage 2 cancer that was grade 3. That person would have been excluded from the pembrolizumab study. Only grade 4 folks with T2A lesions were allowed. They did not allow folks with M0 disease in here, in this study. So that was another difference. And they also only allowed folks with T3 to T4 lesions, whereas T2B lesions were allowed in the nivolumab study. So they allowed some lower risk patients in the nivolumab study. Another big difference in this nivolumab study is they did basically 6 months of adjuvant treatment, whereas the pembrolizumab study did a year of adjuvant treatment. So perhaps that year-long duration is needed. If you look in the textbooks, And the goal of adjuvant therapy, or the benefit of adjuvant therapy, what we're doing is trying to kill micrometastatic disease. And areas of micrometastatic disease, we think, is the environment where immunotherapy, it would be more beneficial. So it makes sense that adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibitor would be effective in this space, but it's finding the right patients and in the right duration of treatment perhaps could be a reason we see the OS benefit with Pembro and with Nivo, not even disease-free survival benefit, which certainly is disappointing to the nivolumab folks. All right, staying in the genitourinary space, we had, I think, a relatively small approval in the bladder cancer space, or urothelial carcinoma, but could have larger implications down the road. And this is a cytokine fusion protein approval. The brand name here is Anktiva. And I'm just trying to pronounce this for the first time. Nogapendekin alpha in bacacept, which is a, the website calls an IL-15 super agonist. But it's an IL-15 receptor agonist that is actually, it's an IL-15 mutant. So it's a mutated form of interleukin-15 that I guess is better or more activating. And it's actually conjugated to an IL-15 alpha receptor alpha that then has basically higher affinity for IL-15 receptors on neurokinin, or natural killer cells, CD4 positive T cells, and CD8 positive T cells without activating T regulatory cells. So really immune activating. And this specific approval is for BCG unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder cancer in patients who have basically, they've already had BCG and their cancer, their urothelial carcinoma, went away and came back in a very short amount of time, like in 12 months, or never went away in the first place. A couple things about this. Nogapendekin alpha in bacacept, which I'm finding fun to say. This is given as an induction phase intravesically, 400 micrograms with BCG once a week for 6 weeks, kind of a standard induction schedule. And then you could do a second induction if you don't get a complete response. There's a maintenance phase, basically every 3 weeks, once a week for 3 weeks, every 3 months after induction for a period of time, along with BCG. Notably, instillation into the bladder needs to be done no more than 2 hours, for a total of 2 hours after you puncture the vial. So there does have some limited ability here, or stability. Side effects are what you see with intravesicular treatments like dysuria, pretty common, increased creatinine, maybe some hematuria, urination frequency, things like that. This is a single-arm study. This is called QUILT 3.032, 77 patients. Now, you may recall from a couple years ago, there's a very similar approval for pembrolizumab in this space, and that pembro approval is for high-risk persistent disease or recurrent disease after a period of tumor-free period. This definition here for this approval for nogapendekin alpha in bacacept is BCG unresponsiveness, which is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, that's carcinoma in situ, that's persistent or recurrent in situ disease, or even TA or T1 disease within 12 months of an adequate BCG trial, which allows you to miss some doses, and that's similar to what they did in this Pembro study. The complete response rate with this new drug is 62%. It was 41% in the Pembro study. Both of these are single-arm studies. We should not make that cross-trial comparison. This is an intravesicular treatment versus a systemic treatment in pembrolizumab. And I'll point out that the Pembro approval specifically is for patients who are ineligible or have chosen not to have cystectomy. Not the case here for this approval for Anktiva. I will point out that just today I saw on my X timeline, there's a phase 2 study of this agent in non-small cell lung cancer that the company is in their press release saying has shown overall survival benefit compared to some other treatment in patients with non-small cell lung cancer who've already received immune checkpoint inhibitor. So that could potentially be huge if there's a drug that shows activity in lung cancer after immune checkpoint inhibitor exposure. You have to be very cautious about buying the hype of overall survival in a phase 2 study, which almost certainly was not the primary endpoint, shouldn't be in a phase 2 study, smaller study, so there's more likely to be noise that could just be chance. So we'll have to wait to follow up on this drug, but as of now, this is on the market and an option for those folks who desire local treatments and are BCG unresponsive. All right, As we just kind of talked a little bit about this not investigational agent, but now this FDA-approved agent, this IL-15 super agonist, we're going to stay in the lung cancer space since that drug appears to have activity in lung cancer, and talk about the overall survival analysis of the APPLE study. This is an aortic study. So this is a European cooperative group study that the primary results were published a while back, and the primary goal of this study was to compare osimertinib for newly diagnosed non-small cell lung cancer, EGFR mutated, compared to gefitinib followed by osimertinib either at the time of disease progression or if, say, a liquid biopsy showed a T790M mutation. So it's looking at, is OC upfront better than OC later? So it's a sequencing study. Is the drug better now or is the drug better later? So the primary endpoint was 18-month progression-free survival, which favored osimertinib. Now, this is a phase 2 study, so we're only talking like 150 patients total. So pretty small study. So if you have a very small study, kind of it's more likely your null hypothesis will be met, the null hypothesis being no difference. There was a difference for 18-month progression-free survival. However, there was not a difference in overall survival between these two groups with a hazard ratio of 1.01, confidence interval 0.61 to 1.68. So very underpowered as a study for overall survival, but certainly compelling, and, you know, has me shouting, we need to continue to say the sequencing of these drugs. And we don't always need to move everything forward because there may be just as much benefit to saving it in a second line setting as we seem to see from the SONIA study from ASCO last year with cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6 inhibitors in the breast cancer space. So really interesting study. I don't think we'll get a larger study because now so many folks are going to be getting, adjuvant osimertinib in this space. But a wonderful question. Kudos to aortic for doing this question. Perhaps this is will be evidence in Europe to maybe use a cheaper drug like gefitinib or erlotinib compared to osimertinib up front for everybody and reserving osimertinib for progression. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that there was a benefit with regards to CNS-free survival with osimertinib. I'll also point out that there was about 10% more people in the gefitinib group who had brain mets at baseline, and osimertinib has good blood-brain barrier penetration, certainly better than gefitinib. So if anything, the gefitinib study was stacked up to do poorer. And they did do poor from a CNS disease standpoint, but there didn't appear to be any difference in overall survival. And I did say that it is overpowered, but you can look at the Kaplan-Meier curve yourself, and you're not seeing any. There's not a trend towards overall survival for osimertinib. Certainly, those curves look pretty superimposable, albeit very small sample size in the space of 150 patients. Okay. Final solid tumor update, and then I've got something for the malignant heme folks. So the Metallica study, this is a phase 2 study that I shared on my Instagram stories. Basically, this is a pretty simple study, but a really nice study of breast cancer patients taking alpelisib, which we know causes a really high rate of hyperglycemia. Certainly, we love the title of this study, Metallica. It's a small study, so there's only 48 patients starting alpelisib who were normoglycemic, and then 20 patients who had prediabetes. And what they did in these two cohorts is they put them on metformin upfront, which the alpelisib PI says to consider, I think, basically. So we know based on the PI and from other data in alpelisib that about one-third of patients have grade 3 or grade 4 hyperglycemia, which I should have looked up the definition of grade 4 hyperglycemia before I did this, so I'm trying to do that right now. But if 1 in 3 have grade 3 or 4 hyperglycemia, that's kind of our baseline here, even though we do not have a comparison group. This is a single arm study. The rates of grade 3 or 4 hyperglycemia in the folks who were normotensive taking metformin and the metformin schedule they did here was 500 BID for 3 days, and that if no GI intolerance, they increased to 100 BID that was 2.1% had grade 3 hyperglycemia if they had normal glucose at baseline entry versus 15% for those folks who had prediabetes, certainly much lower than the 33%. Again, that's a cross-trial comparison, but we know the drug causes a lot of hyperglycemia, and this certainly seems to improve that. So, you know, what I'm looking at here, this is the version 5, the common terminology criteria for adverse events. Grade 3 hyperglycemia is insulin's needed or hospitalization. Grade 4 is life-threatening. So it doesn't appear to have a glucose tied to it that at least I'm seeing. And I've searched for glycemia and searched for glucose. So should have looked for that in advance. So anyway, so that's alpelisib. So we've talked alpelisib. We've talked some GU. We've talked some lung cancer. Now let's talk about CPX351. This is the liposomal cytarabine daunorubicin drug that gained a lot of notoriety for a study in MDS-related MDL or therapy-related MDL that showed an apparent overall survival benefit to 7+3. Now, critics appropriately have called out the study design because the 7+3 arm got post-remission therapy with 5+2, which is probably a substandard care for these folks. Now, many of them are elderly, so you could argue they couldn't tolerate a higher dose cytarabine regimen. That might be a fair concession here. But what puzzled me about this study is CPX351 compared to 7+3. If you look at like response rates and things like that, and you know that first cycle of treatment, the folks with CPX351 had like a week longer nadir, like a full week longer almost of severe neutropenia without an apparent increased risk of infections. And quite frankly, that made no sense to me. I almost didn't believe it. I was like, something funny has to be going on here if you're having longer duration of neutropenia and you're not having infections. What is going on here? Well, maybe there's an answer for this, an explanation. And this is in a blood from Renga and colleagues from also last week. And the title of this is CPX351 Exploits the Gut Microbiota to Promote Mucosal Barrier Function, Colonization Resistance, and Immune Homeostasis. Now, this is a study done in cell culture and mouse models. I cannot even begin to go into critiquing this the way that it needs to be done. So this is, I'm just putting out here for your information because people may be talking about it with CPX351. And I'm going to just read from the abstract here is, quote, we found that CPX351 protected from gut dysbiosis, mucosal damage, and gut morbidity while increasing antifungal resistance, and that they think this protective effect had something to do with activation of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor interleukin 22 IL-10 host pathway and production of immune modulatory metabolites by anaerobes. So I guess it was gut protective in a way. You know, when you are severely neutropenic, the source of infection usually comes from your mouth or your intestines. So if there is a way that a drug, and this is what the CPX351 preclinical data demonstrated, is there's more drug delivery to, say, to the bone marrow cells as opposed to other cells, that maybe there is less intestinal damage from this drug at the cost of more bone marrow damage, which might be beneficial for the MDS or the leukemia, and then potentially, I don't know, maybe lead to fewer infectious complications because you're not allowing the host pathogens from the GI tract to translocate to the bloodstream. I don't know. Smarter people than me need to look at this. But this, it's interesting. I don't usually read the abstracts in blood because often they're very, very technical and laboratory-based and blood-based in the laboratory, which is beyond my expertise. But that one did catch my eye when I read it. Anyway, worth sharing. I'll have links to these in the show notes and probably put up some stuff on Instagram with these papers so to call them out a bit more. Thank you for listening. You can follow me on the app formerly known as Twitter at PharmDNIP. Follow the podcast on X, Threads, and Instagram at OncoPharmPod. And until I talk to you again, remember, doses matter.